Sunward, I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of. Wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. From the poem, High Flight, by John Gillespie McGee. Welcome to Delmarva today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. On a windy day in 1903, after an abortive first flight, brother Wilbur Wright took the controls and piloted the Wright brothers' spruce-constructed plane to a flight lasting 12 seconds over a distance of 120 feet. It was the first real flight of an engine-powered aircraft. 24 years later, it took Charles Lindbergh 33 and a half hours to fly 3,600 miles from New York to Paris in the first nonstop transatlantic flight. In 1989, the Concorde was capable of making the flight in just under 3 hours. The Concorde was retired in 2003. Today, the normal flight time from New York to Paris is a little over 7 hours in the Boeing 777. My guest today is Scott Slater. Scott pilots a 777 on a global route for Federal Express. Scott is a former fighter pilot and a graduate of the Naval Academy. He was a Top Gun pilot and flew the FA-18 from aircraft carriers based on both the Atlantic and the Pacific coasts. In addition, Scott participated in an exchange program with the French, patrolling the no-fly zone over Bosnia-Herzegovina. Based in Norfolk in 2000, Scott was selected Atlantic Fleet Pilot of the Year, as well as Carrier Pilot of the Year. Oh, and in the spirit of full disclosure, Scott Slater is my son-in-law. Scott, welcome to Delmarva today.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here. And just so your listeners know, the opinions that I express today are my personal opinions and not those of FedEx.
That's fine, Scott. Scott, let me begin with a personal question. Actually, two personal questions, if I might. When did you first realize that you wanted to fly airplanes? And what was it then about flying that attracted you then and still attracts you today?
Well, you know, to answer that, it's very difficult for the first question because I can't remember when I decided that I wanted to fly airplanes. I think I wanted to fly airplanes before I could walk. So I don't have a specific time because I've always wanted to. I know growing up, my grandparents lived near Seattle, and every summer I would spend my birthday with them in July. And I was always there for the Seattle Seafair. And every year, the Blue Angels do their flight demonstration over the city of Seattle and Lake Washington. And I know that was vivid in my memory from my childhood. And, you know, it was a dream, and I'm still living that dream today.
What was it then that attracted you to the Naval Academy and to flying the F/A-18 for the Navy?
Well, I always have been, I've had a patriotic heart, and I've always wanted to serve my country. But I also, you know, I've always wanted to be a pilot. And I thought that, you know, the pinnacle of aviation would be to be a fighter pilot. And the pinnacle of a fighter pilot would be able to land that aircraft on an aircraft carrier after a flight. And so I think, to me, it was the ultimate accomplishment in aviation then and even today, I think.
For our listening audience, I think everyone is familiar, perhaps, or at least most people, with Tom Cruise and Top Gun. And I believe that you were a pilot at Top Gun. And what was that? That was a training experience, Scott, I believe. What was that experience like?
Yes, it was an amazing experience. And essentially, very few pilots go through that program, and you're selected by your squadron commanding officer and executive officer. And how it works is essentially it's a graduate level course in fighter pilot tactics and procedures. And the folks who complete that program come back to the squadron and become the training officer. And since not everyone can go through the program, they'll use the folks that go through to be able to come back and impart that knowledge upon the rest of the squadron and help to bring the squadron up to current levels of training, tactics, and procedures.
Well, Scott, the F/A-18 is clearly an elite aircraft, and as you've indicated, kind of the elite among the fighter pilot airplanes. And we said, you remember in our poem that I opened with, John Gillespie McGee says, "I have done 100 things you have not dreamed of." Well, I think that has to be the case in terms of someone flying a plane like the F/A-18 to do things that other people have not even dreamed of. Again, we have a hint from the films that we've seen, but I take a minute, if you don't mind, to tell us what it was like getting in that F/A-18 and flying it.
Well, it's an amazing feeling, and it is very difficult to describe. It's much different than sitting in a passenger airplane or even a small airplane. And I guess the best way to think about it, and we actually talk about it this way, when you get into the aircraft, you physically strap in the ejection seat with the parachute, and you strap your legs in, your anti-G suit. But what we talk about it as strapping on the airplane. In other words, not strapping into the airplane, because once you take off and you're in flight, that's really what it feels like. It becomes another appendage. It's a part of you. And it's difficult to get that feeling unless you are in an airplane like that, in a high-performance airplane, and doing that. It's much different than riding along, because everything that you do and everything that you think is manifested in that airplane that's essentially behind you, but it feels like it's a part of you, and you are making it move with your intentions and do exactly what you want it to do. So it's an amazing experience. It's a ultimate freedom, I guess, to be able to move in three dimensions at the speed of sound. It's incredible and very difficult to to describe what it's like.
I'm assuming you feel the power of the plane and you become part of that power.
Absolutely. Yes. It's actually essential to feel the power and the changes in power when you go down to what we call air combat maneuvering or dogfighting. You need to be able to feel what that airplane is doing and what it's doing for you and what it's not doing for you. And you learn to manipulate the power of the engines, the way you manipulate the controls, the angle of attack, the airflow over the airplane, and use all of those different things to be able to maneuver the airplane in a way that will give you an advantage over the aircraft that you're fighting. And it's not just about power. It's a lot of that has to do with finesse and maneuvering the airplane and knowing your airplane to its core and being able to take it to the furthest level possible without stalling, without departing controlled flight and things like that. And it takes time and training and effort to get to that level.
Do you fly the plane, Scott? It sounds as though you do, or do the computers fly the plane?
Well, it is a fly-by-wire system is what they call it. And, you know, we joke about it that we're a voting member of the flight control system. Essentially, in a traditional airplane, an older airplane, your stick is connected to the elevator, to the ailerons, and your feet are connected to the rudder. In an airplane like the F-18, it has electronic flight control. So what you do with the stick and the rudder, you're telling it what you want to do, but those actions will be put into a flight control computer, and you're telling it what you want to do by the force with which you're pushing on the stick or pushing on the rudders. And then it will ultimately, through that flight control computer, give you the controls that you need, because there are multiple electronic controls on the airplane. I could not physically, no man or woman could physically manipulate the controls on the airplane because of the aircraft loads on it. When you are pulling 7, 7.5, 8 G's, incredible aerodynamic loads on the airplane, a person couldn't do that. So that's why it takes flight control computer and then servos, electronic servos that move those systems for you. And that's why it takes a computer to do that.
Well, Atlantic Fleet Pilot of the Year, Carrier Pilot of the Year, 2 awards the same year. I would think that you must have mastered as much as one can master a machine like that. You mastered the plane, but let's shift to another aircraft. Now you went from flying this F-18, strapping it on and piloting it to flying the 777 for FedEx. What is it like now flying the 777?
It's a beautiful airplane, and I enjoy it every day I go to work. I really do. It's a different airplane, but it's a very capable airplane, and it's a wonderful airplane. Works very well for FedEx's business model, and it's a pleasure to fly. It really is. It's a very stable airplane and a very capable airplane.
Well, as I said, it's one of the largest, if not the largest, plane in service, and you can correct me on that if I'm wrong, but it sounds like it is not a plane that you put on.
Not exactly, and it doesn't feel quite the same. The cockpit's a little bigger, and there's more room to move around, and it is one of the bigger. It's not the biggest, probably the biggest, at least, well, the two biggest airplanes in the world are the Boeing 747 800 and then the Airbus A380, and there is not a cargo version of the Airbus A380, but the 747 is a little bit bigger than the 777. There are some goods and others, and the 777 only has two engines as opposed to four. So as far as efficiency and, you know, payload to fuel burned and fuel economy, it's an amazing airplane. But yeah, it is a different feeling getting into the airplane and flying the airplane, of course.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, you fly, I said earlier that you fly the global route for FedEx. That means you are flying all over the world, or at least many, many places in the world. Do I have the terminology right? Is it the global route? And where do you go for FedEx in this plane?
FedEx operates a global network, and that's really what it is. And flying the 777 is mainly an international airplane. So what we do is we fly from the United States and in our network around the world. So all really the major cities in the world, in Europe, Paris, Frankfurt, Cologne, Milan, London, in the Middle East, Dubai, New Delhi in India, Mumbai, in Asia, major cities in Asia, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Osaka, Shanghai, Beijing, Singapore, the Philippines, Australia, Hawaii. So what my airplane does is we will operate on these large routes, bringing freight between continents, and then intra-Asia, intra-Europe. There are smaller airplanes that do many of the smaller cities within on those continents. So we do the macro network, and then you have smaller airplanes doing the intra-continent distribution.
Well, I was wondering, Scott, you fly on occasion, if not often, to China, and you were flying to China before the coronavirus struck. What was it like to fly into China? And is it a similar experience in many of these large cities that you named? Is the experience, as I said, similar, or are the cities different? Is it different to fly into Paris than it is to fly into Beijing, say? And then the second question to that is, since the virus, how has landing and flying into China and Paris, for example, Beijing and Paris, for example, changed since the virus has hit the world?
The first part of the question, from an aviation perspective, it's very similar. We have standard procedures around the world for aircraft operations. One thing different in China is they fly in meters. So instead of feet, we fly in feet, and generally flight levels in thousands of feet altitude. In China, and China is the only country left in the world that operates in meters. But it's not terribly different. We do a translation from meters to feet, and then we'll fly the airplane. And we have an indication in the aircraft of the flight levels that we're flying in meters and feet. But from an aviation perspective, flying into any major city is mostly the same. We have procedures for arrivals, standard types of instrument arrivals and approaches, the same thing with departures. So that is very, very similar. As far as pre-coronavirus, after landing and on the layovers, pretty much the same. It used to be we'll finish our park the aircraft safely at the gate, write up any maintenance issues if there were any, and then we'll go to the hotel for the layover. And that was pretty much standard, and things are very, very different now.
How are they now,
and
Scott?
It started changing. Well, right now it's typical to land and go to the hotel and essentially be put into self-isolation or self-quarantine. where in many cities we're not allowed to leave our hotel rooms because of country rules and regulations to self-quarantine. Many passengers, and these procedures change sometimes daily, passengers coming in may have to quarantine for 14 days. They may have to do a COVID-19 test before they're allowed to enter the country. And then they may have to self-quarantine for 14 days. And then they're allowed to go on their way. Since that's not feasible operating an airline, they essentially will allow us to go to designated hotels. And like I said, we pretty much self-quarantine in our rooms and seldom, if ever, are allowed to leave. There are some hotels where we arrive, we check in, we go to our rooms, and we don't leave until we leave to go back to fly the next flight out. Other countries have relaxed a little bit, and where you can leave your room, but you can't leave the hotel. And other go to a restaurant or go to a gym. You know, that's another thing that was changed. It was very, very difficult to, you know, I always try to stay in shape and exercise, you know, try to combat the fatigue, the time zone changes, the circadian rhythm changes, and that's been very difficult to do because a lot of the gyms and you know, sport facilities have been closed due to coronavirus as well.
In the EU countries, European Union countries, the people from the United States at this point, I believe, are not allowed in the country. How does that work for you as a pilot? Is it the same?
We essentially are in a different category because for the same reasons, it's impractical and if not impossible, if you know, every flight crew that landed had to sit somewhere for 14 days, they would very, you know, airlines and would very quickly run out of flight crews. So it was relaxed initially in the EU in, I believe it was March and April when they initiated their lockdown. We were confined to the hotel rooms. That has since been relaxed, but specifically for Americans now, where it's kind of going back to potential self-isolation again. And this is something that's changing daily. But for example, this week, France just changed their rules. And we're not sure at this point whether the first thing is you have to have a negative test before you can come into the country. At this point, flight crews are exempt, but that we do get tested, but we're exempt, but we're going to have to self-isolate in our hotel rooms. And flight crews that are not able to have a test would have to self-isolate, potentially be subject to not allowed to come into certain countries. But you're seeing the European Union has been fairly coherent in their rules and regulations. And now we're just starting to see differences between countries because France is the first that has come up with different rules and requiring us to have tests or to self-isolate.
I wanted to ask you about tests, Scott. How often are you tested?
FedEx has done a phenomenal job of providing pilots with testing, and I'll essentially get tested. I try to, and normally it's possible to do so at the beginning of any international trip, and then I'll do the same upon my return before I go home. And in China, we are subjected to mandatory testing many times, unless if you're going to lay over in the country. You're in some countries, you're allowed to come in and operate and then leave again. But right now, Dubai, China, and I think those are the only two at this point that have mandatory testing criteria, and some of the EU countries, as I said, are starting to have that. And a problem has been, you know, with availability of testing, and that's why we had the self-isolation. FedEx was able to come up with testing fairly early on in the process, which gave us a lot of confidence going overseas. But now testing is becoming more and more available and more countries are requiring it.
I'm sure you talked to other global pilots of other carriers. Are things basically the same? Or is the testing basically the same? And are the pilots, and in fact, do you talk with pilots from other carriers?
We do when we have the opportunity. And of course, you know, the company's always in communication, and our pilot union is in communication with other unions. And, you know, unfortunately, especially early on, some of the testing that was mandated was not, you know, there are many different types of tests. You have even the nasal swabs, there are different types of nasal swabs. And some of them are a bit, I guess you would say, onerous and can be painful. And that was, you know, our biggest concern early on, and all the other pilots that I've ever talked to had those concerns that we weren't always 100% sure of the training, the medical training of the folks that are giving the tests. We're not sure about, you know, if these tests have been vetted, but it's very difficult when you arrive into another country and that country says, well, you're subject to this testing, it's mandatory. And a lot of times we're kind of caught in the middle, and we've had folks subject to things that they probably didn't necessarily want to do, but sometimes you know, you have to do that. And we've tried to, and the company and our union have all tried to smooth out those procedures and ensuring that folks who are conducting those tests are medically trained professionals, and just so that we can trust that we're being handled properly. But there is a large variance.
Scott, are you tested before you come home? I have a special investment in your home, as you know. So are you tested? And I'm sure you are before you come home.
Yes. And very, very early on, I think the first trip when I came back after all these things were happening, I self-quarantined for away from my home for several days. And then I kind of just treated it almost like an old military deployment. And then I left on my next trip. And very soon after that, the testing became available. So now upon return from every trip, I'm able to get tested, and it's wonderful because the testing that we have available is a 15-minute test. So I can come back from a trip, I'm tested, I know I'm negative, and a few hours later I can leave and come home being confident that I'm not bringing anything back to my family.
Scott, truly you're on the front lines flying all over the world with this virus waiting for you and following you as well. I want to thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for your service during your Navy career. And a special thanks for joining me today on Delmarva today. Absolutely. And I want to thank all of you for listening to Delmarva today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.